Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Okay, well, a little housekeeping. We see the full lunacy of the Republican Party on display. Isolationist, willing to abdicate U.S. leadership globally, unconcerned that they now have a candidate who openly supports dictators in wars of aggression, who said that he would encourage Putin to do whatever the hell he wants to our NATO allies if they don't spend enough on their own defense. Because they're, quote, delinquent in their payments, as though the defense of Western civilization has all the significance of a rental dispute over a condominium in Florida. I mean, it would be one thing to argue for American isolationism and to reconsider our involvement in foreign conflicts. I do think it would be easy to take the other side of that argument and to make the case that pulling back from the world that is failing to defend democracies against aggressive autocracies, failing to defend our traditional allies, losing NATO, etc., I think it would be easy to argue that all of that would be very bad, not just for the world, but for American security, eventually. But what we see on the right is not merely an America First agenda. We see a totally amoral, and in many cases immoral, fondness for dictators, and for Putin in particular, and for the total eclipse of liberal values. For the outright destruction of liberal institutions. We see fellow travelers and useful idiots propagandizing for autocracy. And speaking of idiots, useful or otherwise, we have Tucker Carlson, this well-established liar and fabulist and crackpot, broadcasting his smug ignorance from Mother Russia, to the delight of Putin, obviously, and of the populist right in America, but insanely also to the delight of some of the most prominent podcasters and tech bros who are not themselves right-wing idiots at all. I won't name names, but Jesus Christ. These people are acting as though just sticking a microphone in front of Putin for 2 hours and looking servile was a heroic act of investigative journalism. Now, of course, many people have savaged Tucker, and in particular responded to his delusional comments about how much better life is in Moscow than in any American city. Fareed Zakaria had a great response on his show and in the Washington Post. Jon Stewart did his bit. And this would all be hilarious, because it's so ludicrous, if so many people weren't taken in by it. Needless to say, Trump's and Tucker's and the right wing's embrace of Putin looks even more vile in light of the recent death of Alexei Navalny. In Putin, we're talking about a leader who imprisons and murders his political opponents. He even murders his critics in foreign capitals, like London. He imprisons and murders journalists. He even imprisons American journalists and even Russian billionaires. I mean, how did we get to the point that something like half of America can't see what's wrong with this? Anyway, I'm going to do a podcast on the war in Ukraine soon with someone who actually knows something about it. And no doubt there will be more to say about Russia and Putin at that point. I have a book recommendation to make. A book just came out in the US. I think it came out in the UK maybe a year earlier. The title is The Holocaust, An Unfinished History by Dan Stone. A very readable book. And the audio is actually quite good. No matter how much you imagine you know about the Holocaust, revisiting it is always astonishing. And this is a particularly good window onto it. We actually invited Dan on the podcast, and he declined. I think he said he had done enough podcasts. I don't see the evidence of him having done enough podcasts, frankly. Perhaps I'm missing something. But it almost never happens that someone declines. I think I can still count on one hand the number of times someone has said no to appearing on the podcast. So it doesn't happen much. If any of you are friends of Dan's or colleagues and you think we would have a good conversation, you might ask him to reconsider. I think we'd have a great conversation, and I love his book. Whether he ever comes on the podcast or not, I recommend you all go out and buy it and read it at this moment, because I'm really enjoying it, if enjoying is the right word. It's quite good. In today's podcast, the question and perhaps inevitability of American isolationism does come up, because today I'm speaking with Peter Zion, Peter is a geopolitical strategist and a global energy, demographic, and security expert. He is the author of several books, but he has re-released his first, The Accidental Superpower, and updated it, which is the focus of today's conversation. Last time he was on the podcast, I brought Ian Bremmer on with me to essentially backstop my ignorance of a lot of these issues and to help me get the most out of Peter. This time I flew the plane myself, and you can be the judge of whether or not I landed the thing safely, or whether there should now be crosses and bouquets of flowers strewn along the tarmac. I must say, Peter is so confident in his prognostications that I find it a little disconcerting, both because so much of what he predicts is scary, but also his confidence worries me a little too. You know, I push back in certain places, or at least ask him to consider counterfactuals. So make of my contributions to this conversation what you will. I think Peter is fascinating to listen to. Some of his predictions are relatively near term, which is fun. For instance, he thinks there is no way that Trump will win in November. We'll see the results of that soon enough. And many of his most dire predictions for the fate of Europe and China and elsewhere, these are not many, many decades out. He's thinking in terms of 10 and 15 years for a lot of this stuff. So anyway, very interesting, extraordinarily bleak, and yet the picture for America is pretty rosy. That is, if we survive the nuclear war that he thinks is probably coming. But more of that soon. Anyway, we speak about the unraveling world order. We discuss the Bretton Woods system, America's role in securing the global supply chain, the coming end of these security guarantees, the shrinking of the U.S. Navy, Houthi terrorism in the Red Sea, deterring Iran, conflict in the Middle East, the future of Israel, the limits of immigration, the demographic pyramid, the coming demise of Europe, the war in Ukraine, the prospect of nuclear war, demographic collapse in China, the threat of loose nukes in Russia, America's relative immunity to the world's chaos, U.S. debt, the southern border and immigration policy, why Trump will not win the 2024 election, and other topics. And now I bring you the fascinating Peter Zion. I am here with Peter Zion. Peter, thanks for joining me again.
Great to be back.
So, since we last spoke, we spoke in our first conversation about your book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning. And since then, you have reissued your first book, or at least it was your first book that I'm aware of, The Accidental Superpower. And you've reissued it 10 years on, updating your predictions and analysis. So we'll focus on that. And I just to remind people, you seem to argue in at least in the two books I've read and in much of the other material I've seen from you, that some combination of geography and demography is destiny, right? Which is very, I must say, very counterintuitive to those of us who tend to think in terms of the power of ideas, right? So your analysis tends to suggest that you can have the whatever ideas you want, but if you live in a malarial swamp without navigable waterways, you're basically screwed.
There's only so much you can do with an idea in that situation.
Yeah. So, feel free to correct any misapprehension I might have with your general take on things, but that's the general lesson I tend to draw, and I just want to get into all the details. I think where I want to land with you is in a discussion about this new spirit of American isolationism, which is, you know, kind of a waning of the Pax Americana that we've all taken for granted, you know, modulo a few hiccups, like a few wars that we think better of now. But there's this new populist desire for isolationism, and this is emerging at a time where there's this seemingly new authoritarian axis that emerging with China and Russia and Iran and North Korea. Perhaps there are others that should be put in there. And many people in America seem to want our country to become some version of a nuclear-armed Switzerland, where we just stay out of the world's conflicts. And you seem to be arguing that that's going to happen whether people want it or not. And you know, populism and Trumpism might be pushing it, but there are geopolitical changes that are just going to make it happen anyway. And you also have a very optimistic take for how America lands in all of this. So I want to save America for the end, but obviously it's going to come up again and again as you analyze the rest of the world. But I thought we could probably start, as you do in your book, with the Bretton Woods Agreement, and you can remind people what that was and what its consequences were, and then we could just track through various regions landing with the U.S. and North America.
That works for me.
Nice. So Bretton Woods, what was it, and what were its consequences?
When most people think of Bretton Woods, they're thinking of the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank and the idea of a new financial architecture in the aftermath of World War II. And it was all of that and more. But the core issue was this concept that the United States military would go out and make the global oceans safe for anyone's commerce, no matter who you were, no matter what you did, no matter where you were selling, no matter who you were partnering with. Anyone could go anywhere. And that was a fundamental change in the international environment, because it allowed countries that honestly had lost the war and lost badly to emerge from the wreckage with trade access as if they were the world's most powerful empire and could get anywhere at any time. Now, there was a catch there. For the Americans to do this for you, you had to sign up to be on our side during the Cold War. And that provided us with the alliance network that we needed to contain and ultimately beat back the Soviet Union. Another characteristic of this structure was that the United States would not invest its economy in this new international network, because if it had done that, it would have just been another conquering empire. So we got this global structure where the United States did the heavy lifting on a security front and allowed this parallel economic structure to happen on a global basis, of which the Americans were at most side participants in. It's not that we didn't play at all, but as a percentage of GDP, we remain the least involved economy in the world, especially if you factor out the NAFTA countries modern day. In terms of total import-export, where you're looking at something that's less than 5% of GDP, which is, you know, a drop in the bucket compared to what it is for most other countries.
I don't think that's widely appreciated. I think that's, in fact, I was fairly surprised to hear that we don't export all that much.
Well, the numbers are going to be different based on who's doing the data, because different people weight different things differently and don't even count certain things. And when you're talking about modern manufacturers where there's thousands of supply chain steps, getting good data is difficult at best. But pretty much everybody's data says that somewhere between 10 and 20% of US GDP is involved in imports and exports in some way. But roughly half of that is the NAFTA network. And roughly a third of what's left is U.S. energy and energy product exports. And so if you pull those out, you're talking 5% of GDP is all that's left.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll get to Island America eventually. So you're saying that we basically have policed world trade without being ourselves as nearly as dependent upon it as the countries we've been helping police.
Right. So if you go up until 1992, because that's where we have a bit of a split in policy and decision making, up until that point, pretty much all of our involvement in the Middle East wasn't about getting crude out of the region for us. It was about getting crude out of the region for our allies, because the North American market for energy has largely been self-contained since the beginning. Remember that we were one of the major exporters during World War II that allowed the Europeans and even the Russians to fight. And that generated a very different economic model, because we experienced things like the oil shocks in the 70s, because oil prices are internationally linked. It is a broadly fungible and liquid commodity financially. But we were never in danger of an actual shortage. It was a price issue here. The shortage was in an Eastern Hemispheric problem. It was a problem for Japan. It was a problem for Germany. And that's why we were involved, because the idea was, if the United States does not rise to the occasion and contain instability in the Middle East, then the Allies would no longer have an economic interest in partnering with the United States on security affairs. And for us, that was the only thing that mattered. And that's the reason why Iran, once it turned fundamentalist in 1979, was always an issue, because Iran always had that threat over the Persian Gulf energy exports. And if that went away, the alliance could theoretically go away. And so even now, 40 years later, when the United States is more and more populist and is less interested in maintaining all of this for any number of reasons, mostly domestic politics, we still get this knee-jerk reaction to anything that happens against Iran because we have been so exposed. That has always been the raw nerve. In many ways, Iran has always been the country on the planet that had the greatest capacity to disrupt our overall security plans. Now, I would argue that's no longer the case. We've moved on. But the emotional inertia there is immense. And we're certainly seeing that in political decisions today.
So how and why is Bretton Woods coming to an end?
Oh, you have to go back to the fact that we won the Cold War. And after 1992, we started to have a conversation with ourselves about what's Bretton Woods 2? How do we take this alliance, the greatest alliance in human history, and play it forward for another generation or two of American preeminence? How do we remake the human condition? How do we spread free market capitalism? How do we improve the rates of human rights? How do we push women's rights? How do we make the world a better place that we can then leave to our descendants? And the person who tried to get us to have that conversation was George Herbert Walker Bush. And Americans decided that they didn't want to have that conversation. And instead, we went with Bill Clinton, who was much more focused on North America, much more populist and narcissistic. And from there, we went to W. Bush, and from there to Obama, and Obama to Trump, and Trump to Biden. And we've just kind of taken steps down that road. Despite the variety of policies and personalities that we have seen since 1992, what they all have in common is each one is a little bit more economically nationalist than the one that came before. So from an economic and political point of view, we've moved away from this structure. And while that's happened, we've also changed our military, specifically the Navy, into a form that I would argue is no longer even capable of maintaining the globalized network. We used to have a 600-ship Navy dominated by small vessels that could be almost everywhere at once. And so the idea of keeping the sea lanes open against threats was a viable policy. But since 1992, we've steadily reduced the size of the fleet while steadily increasing its tonnage. And so instead of having 600 ships that are mostly small, we now have about 250 ships that are centered around the aircraft carrier battle groups, of which we now have 12 super carriers and 10 jump carriers. And it's really hard for us to function independently of that anymore. Now, if you want to carry out a military operation and knock over a country, you have the right tools for the job. But if you want to throw a wide net and provide naval security everywhere, we no longer have the numbers or the types of ships that are necessary. So look at what's going on in the Red Sea right now with the Houthis taking pot shots at shipping. It is stressing us to the brink of keeping the Red Sea open because we no longer have enough vessels of the type that could do this. And this is arguably, the Houthis are arguably the worst terrorists in the world operating from the most worthless chunk of land. And if we had a second event like this anywhere in the world, I doubt the U.S. Navy could rise to the occasion. So this is pushing us to the very brink of what is possible with our current military posture. And if it fails, the United States is not the country that's going to feel the pain. The country that's going to feel the most pain by far is going to be China because they're the most dependent on open seas.
Which they don't police, despite the fact that the South
even
China
if they
Sea
wanted,
is a mess.
Yeah, even if they wanted to police, they don't have the ships with the range to get there.
Right. Right. Just like maybe we could take a little detour here. What do you think we should do about the Houthis?
Well, like I said, they're the most incompetent terrorists in the world operating from the most worthless land. The only reason at all, in my opinion, that the Houthis matter is because every once in a while they take shots at the Saudi oil complex. But over the last 10 years, the Saudis have put up nets and jammers, which have pretty much reduced the damage to zero. So I am going to go with a big fat don't really care.
But how do you operationalize don't really care when ships can't navigate those waters and they're crucial for oil and much else?
Yeah. I mean, here's the problem. It's not just politics that is driving the United States away from the system. I'd argue between demographic changes, economic reality, the Chinese rise, and the shift in the American naval posture that we can't do it anymore. We're going to have to do something Americans really hate doing. We're going to have to make some choices about what we want to protect and what we want to further. And it's really hard for me to see Yemen being part of that conversation.
Well, I guess now that I've wandered off course here, let's bring Iran into this conversation.
What, sure.
Isn't it really Iran that needs to be successfully deterred here? I mean, the Houthis are widely understood to be one of their proxies. And what do you make of the fact that the massive asymmetry in power between the U.S. and Iran doesn't seem to offer much effective deterrence? I mean, Iran seems to do what it wants more or less with impunity, at least up until this point. What should we do?
We can get into all kinds of trouble with this conversation. Okay, yeah. Let's start with the situation on the ground, and then we can look at American policy. So in the aftermath of the Iraq War, the biggest thing the United States did was remove the single largest regional check on Iran's power and expansion, and that was the government of Saddam Hussein of Iraq. Hmm. And but just by destroying that, and then the way we chose to attempt rebuilding and restructuring in a post-Ba'ath environment, which we did not manage very well, we fully shattered what had been the Mesopotamian check on Persian expansion that had existed for most of the last millennia. In doing so, Iran was able to shove power into southern Iraq, into its Shia zones, and then beyond into places like Jordan and especially Syria and Lebanon. And in doing that, what they usually did is they worked with whatever sectarian group did not hold the whip, the ones that were not in charge, and empowered them to fight back against the ruling order of their zone. And in doing so, basically half burned the entire region down. Now, I don't mean to suggest this was just them. The Saudis got in on it too. And the Saudis did it from the majority position, usually working with Sunni Arab fundamentalists and militants to attack things. So you had elements on both extremes that weren't so much attacking the center, but attacking what passed for the rule of law and what passed for stability in the region. And so all of these states faced a massive degradation in their capacity to function as states. Now, the United States has largely disengaged itself from the region, but where we still have forces that's in play, it's to fight one specific group, the Islamic State or ISIS or whatever you want to call it, which is, to be perfectly blunt, the child of our ally, Saudi Arabia, as opposed to the Iranians. Mm. But the decision has been made by the Trump administration and then doubled down on by the Biden administration that we should keep combat to a minimum and just focus on training and intelligence cooperation with other forces in the region to carry out most of the work. And what that means effectively is that American forces that are in the region don't leave their bases very often. And so if you're an Iranian and you're looking for a very, very, very easy propaganda win, you launch a mortar, you send off a rocket or a drone, you take a pot shot, and even if you hit nothing, it makes a nice little splash of PR that you can use for recruiting wherever you want to operate. You put that against the backdrop of the Gaza war, and of course, hundreds of attacks are going to go against American positions because we're not shooting back, because that is not the order. The Iranian militants, despite how much we don't much care for them, we have decided in Washington that ISIS is the bigger threat. And so we didn't shoot back until one of the drones actually got through and is forcing the Biden administration to reevaluate the entire policy set of this entire region, not just vis-a-vis the Iranian-backed militias, but why we have a footprint there at all. And if the decision comes down, which I think it will in the next year, that there's not really much that we're doing that is useful in this region at all on the ground, then you have to, when you pull those forces out, then you have to take another look at what you're going to do on the seas. So there is a long overdue policy reckoning that has now started in Washington. And it's unclear to me at this moment just how far back we're going to pull out, but everything is on the table. And we probably should have had these conversations 15 years ago, but, you know, better late than never.
Mm. I still am kind of mystified by the failure of deterrence, because wouldn't it be trivially easy for us to just destroy Iran's ports, right? And just basically—
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, there's kind of three ways that the United States could fight back. Number one is just go for a bit of a tit for tat against the militias themselves, whether they're the Houthis or one of these various Hezbollah outcrops anywhere in Jordan or Lebanon, Iraq or Lebanon, or Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, or Iraq. Number two would be to go after Iranian shipping, because most of the weapon systems that are going to places like the Houthis have to go by the water. It's not like they're smuggling these things on land through Saudi Arabia. So you do a kind of a de facto embargo on vessels that are coming out of Iranian ports, especially once they leave the port of Hormuz. And then step three would be to go after their physical assets in the Persian Gulf. Going after their, quote, naval bases won't really do much because most of the Iranian Navy is literally speedboats.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not suggesting that would be hard to take off. I'm just saying that doesn't really move the needle in any meaningful way. You're certainly not going to do an assassination program on the mainland because there's just too many people. This isn't China where it's a one-man show, or Russia where the entire elite's under 140 people. This is a full-on theocracy with literally over 10,000 people in the political elite. There's no assassination program that would make any sense there or have an end. But you could destroy their oil industry very easily because it's pretty much all shipped out via one port,
right,
on Karg Island. And Karg Island doesn't even have a bridge connecting it to the mainland. So if you destroy the facilities on either side of the strait that separates Karg from the mainland, Iranian oil would basically go down, exports would effectively go down to zero and not come back for years.
So now, two questions. Why haven't we done that? And
because we have still not carried out our full assessment of what we want to do in the post-Bretton Woods system. If the United States, who at least officially today, is the guarantor of global naval security, even if it's failing at that role and edging away from it, if we actually go out and attack maritime shipping and energy supplies, that closes off a lot of options in a lot of places. Now, I think in time, we're going to get there anyway. But like I said, we probably should have had a policy reassessment in this region 15 years ago. Hmm. This is part of that.
Yeah, well, so accepting that rationale, why is it that you think Iran is not deterred by the prospect of our doing that? Why are they being as provocative as they are, given how vulnerable they are?
There's a general belief in Iran that the United States has no interest in giving up its global cop role. And as long as that is the case, the more you needle the United States, the more likely they are to come to the table. Now, I personally think that is a miscalculation on their part, but that is the dominant view of most of the folks who think strategically within the country. There's this misunderstanding. It's kind of funny. Iranian foreign policy now for 30 years has been about basically backing the little guy to oppose the Arab and the secular and the American-backed governments throughout the region. And in many cases, the Iranians have gotten exactly what they wanted. But now that the dog has caught the car, they're discovering that this region can't be governed because they've destroyed most of the poles of power and stability throughout the region. There's no one to co-opt. And they've really, really, really pissed off most of the Sunnis and most of the Arabs. And so they've indirectly, in their victories and their successes and in their exploitation of the Iraq War, created exactly the sort of environment that is encouraging all the other regional governments to band together against them. And the Abraham Accords is part of that. So this is what happens in the Middle East when you get what you want. And it's a pretty ugly picture. And they're honestly not sure what they can get next. The reason that they are still in play in such a big way is because they've discovered that their population is actually sufficiently okay with the level of economic isolation and recession that it doesn't inhibit the theocracy's ability to rule. And as long as they believe that, they will keep pushing.
Mm. Okay, so let's widen the picture to the rest of the Middle East. Generally speaking, once again, you seem to blame economic geography for most, if not all, of the dysfunction in the region. I'm wondering how you interpret the success, notwithstanding the security concerns of Israel, in that context.
Well, you know, the region overall, whenever you got an area that's dry to desert, it's hard to have basic agriculture. And if you don't have agriculture, you never get small businesses and you never move up into, say, manufacturing and industry. And so this region has always been left behind. The places where that is least true are the places where it rains. And that is Turkey, and that is Tunisia, and to a lesser degree, Morocco, which are the three most economically advanced states in the region by any measure. The Israelis are unique in many, many, many ways, mostly because when the Jews were brought back in the post-World War II environment, they brought a lot of skill sets that they had developed elsewhere over centuries with them, and a lot of capital, in addition to the strategic sponsorship of the West in general, the United States in particular. And that gave the Israelis access to trade options that no one else in the region had, but they also started working with skill sets that no one else in the region had. And that's allowed them to build up a bit of a technocracy in a region that is known for anything but You got this weird little pocket of service economy and high-tech manufacturing in a sea of something else. And it is because of the people, not because of their ethnicity, but because you've had, you know, a few million people who now call themselves Israelis who for generations lived somewhere else. It's a full-on graft. And it's part of the reason why North America and Australia are just so different from Europe. They took the skill sets that they originated in another place and applied them to Indian geography and made something new, for better or for worse. Now, maintaining the security of a little statelet like that under normal circumstances is impossible because this region, the Levant specifically, has never been powerful enough to look after itself. It's never had the population density to generate a military force that can keep things at bay. And so it's always been at the whim of greater powers, whether those powers be the Turks or the Persians or once even the Mongols. That, countering that, the forces of history and just the sheer demographic overbalance of the tiny size of Israel versus the huge heft of these other players requires a lot of really creative thinking. And what the Israelis have done, sometimes in league with outside powers, sometimes not, is one after another turn the countries that border them either into allies like Egypt, into security proxies like Jordan, basically has become a dependency, or break them in the case of Lebanon, basically becoming a failed state. And I'd argue Syria is pretty close to that as well. It doesn't solve the broader problem of a partnership with those larger outside powers to prevent invasion, but it does give whoever is going to cross in from elsewhere the fact that they have to cross through these other areas first. So let's assume, for example, that the last country that occupied what is today Israel, Turkey, decided it wanted to come back. Well, first it would have to absorb Lebanon and Syria, and there's no one in Turkey who thinks that would be a lot of fun. So it's kind of a firebreak strategy. I don't want to suggest that it's going to work forever, but it's working for now.
Well, what are your expectations for the future of Israel, given the durability of the hatred of the, you know, the surrounding Islamic cultures to varying degrees? What are their prospects from a security point of view?
There's the partnership angle, and then there's the internal angle. The partnership angle is well underway, and if it hadn't been for the Gaza war, we would probably already have a formal peace deal between the Israelis and the Saudis. Now, they have been cooperating fairly tightly for 15 years now. There's a lot of Israeli forces that basically train the Saudis on their own equipment. There's a lot of intelligence cooperation on both sides, especially vis-a-vis Iran. I'm not suggesting that they agree on everything, but whenever the Americans have put official or unofficial sanctions on either country for human rights abuses, they turn to one another in order to play the United States off of whatever the issue happens to be, and then provide direct assistance to the other one in order to get what they want anyway. And it's been a fairly successful model so far because the Americans have not called them on it. So they've had a de facto alliance, I would argue, for at least a decade. And the question that has been up in recent months is whether just to make that formal. There's a generational split within Saudi Arabia about whether they should go formal and get something for the Palestinians as part of it, or just throw the Palestinians under the bus and make it official. And that is a conversation that is very much in play. So in terms of a security guarantor, Saudi Arabia can't play that role. But if the Israelis can flip Saudi Arabia to formally being on the same side as Egypt and Jordan and Morocco, and at least neutral like Turkey is, then you really don't have to worry about the Arab side of the external security threats. And that would be a significant victory. And I think that is now within reach. And I think we're definitely going to see that this decade. The Iranian problem isn't going away, but it's distant. And no one is thinking that there's about to be another Persian empire that's going to expand out and occupy the entire region. The Iranians are too technologically inept at the moment to pull anything like that off. So, you know, that's a problem for a different century. The internal problem, I think, is going to be more of an issue. The success of Israel owes more to itself than it does to American sponsorship. It is because you've got this highly educated population that has carved a little bit green out of the desert, that's made them high value add, that's made their intelligence systems great, that's made their weapon systems among the world's best. But at the same time, they've created this space within their own political and economic system for a class of people who reject everything about modern life and basically study religious texts all day and have a bunch of kids and live on state subsidies. And that's like 30 to 40% of the population now. And so you've got this, this is going to sound incredibly jaded, but a near deadbeat population who is sucking at the teat of the government and sucking the government dry, and yet all voting together in a relatively anti-economic, anti-Arab, anti-peace, anti-cooperation, anti-military block. And they're just, the leaders that get put in from this population are absolutely incompetent. Yet they claim that they represent the true soul of the people, and they claim that they're the security hawks, and they claim they know more about how to run the military than the generals. And their incompetence is in many ways what led to the surprise of last October and November when Hamas made their move. These were the people who were in charge of those institutions, and they ignored all the warnings that were coming up from their professionals who had been in their jobs for decades, and they did so for political reasons.
Well, you'll get no defense of the ultra-Orthodox from me, as you might imagine. Let's move to Europe. You're extraordinarily bearish on Europe. What's the landscape look like there?
So three big problems. Number one, this is a region that has gotten most of its energy from the Russian space. So, you know, that's a problem, especially since that's obviously their number one security threat. They're in the process of trying to wrestle with that right now from a late start. Number two, this is part of the world that industrialized and urbanized very intensely after World War II. And after 70 years, their birth rates have now been so low for so long that Germany and Italy and, those are the big ones, will cease to function as modern economic entities within 10 or 15 years. Because it's not that they ran out of children. That happened 30 years ago. They're running out of working age adults this decade. And there is no economic model that works there. And then number three,
immigration isn't the solution to that?
The problem there is scale. So like take Germany, a country with a little over 80 million people. For them just to hold the line where they are right now, they would need to import 2 million people under age 25 every year for the next 20 years, just to hold the line of where they are now. And that would mean in 20 years, the Germans would be a small minority within their own country. It's not viable. If you want immigration to be part of the solution, you start early. You make it a trickle, you never let up, and you have to consign yourself to a degree of cultural change. If the longer you wait, the more you need to bring in, the sharper the change will be. And for the European nation states, I just don't think it's a viable option, or at least not at scale. There may be some individual exceptions here and there, and there now are a lot of Ukrainians that are looking to settle in a new place. But if all of the Ukrainians who have left, that's like, you know, a quarter of the population of Ukraine is left for Europe. If they all settled in Germany, that's still not enough. Just the immigration as a lever requires a lot of early action. And what that means is you've got an entire continent that is aging towards obsolescence. They no longer have enough people who are young to perpetuate the populations, but that also means they don't have enough people who are young to do the consuming of the economic outputs, which means the third problem, that Germany, Europe in general, is an export-led economic system, and that only works as long as someone is willing to absorb those exports. The United States is turning more nationalist and populist, and it's shrinking what's available. And the Chinese system, even if it survives, which I'm sure we can talk about that next, no longer has a lot of young people either. So most of the exports to China have been in the form of industrial plant to help the Chinese export to yet more countries. It's a bit of a daisy chain that even if you remove issues of ethics and morals and solidarity in Ukraine and Russia from, still is a bit of a starvation diet because there just aren't enough countries with young populations to absorb this volume of advanced age economies exports beyond the end of this decade. So it's a model that is very clearly dying by any number of means, even if the United States decides it still wants to partnership with Europe. And it's not clear that that is the case for the long term. If you look at what's happening with the Biden administration vis-a-vis the Europeans on the topic of Ukraine, every single deal has been about security. Their trade hasn't been brought up once. There is no stomach in the Biden White House to push towards any sort of trade arrangement with the Europeans that will buy them more time.
Hmm. Is there any scenario where technology comes to the rescue, or is this just science fiction? I mean, just imagine perfect robots that fill in for any shortage of human labor in the relevant cohort.
Sure. So there's two big problems if you want to look to, say, automation to solve these problems. Number one is that automation is very expensive, and it's more expensive to maintain it than it is to install it. So it's a cost that builds as you go. And as people move into mass retirement, their ability to generate capital to fund this sort of thing declines. So if you can't front load it, it's probably not going to happen. And then second, let's say you can figure it out. You can automate everything. Okay, well, that may address the production side of the equation. But Europe's problem hasn't been production. It's been consumption. Hmm. And robots, at least yet, don't consume.
Don't buy things. We can fix that.
Yeah.
Actually, take a moment to review your the demographic pyramid and sketch, as you just began to, the responsibilities of the different age brackets in terms of how they contribute to the economy, to production, consumption, investment,
sure,
et cetera.
So in a quote, normal, unquote system, especially before World War II, you had a pyramid structure. You had very few retirees, and then slightly more mature workers, people in their 40s, 50s, and early 60s. And below that, even more young workers in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s. And below that, lots and lots and lots of children. It's a traditional pre-industrial demographic structure because it's all about having lots of free kids because they're free labor on the farm. But as globalization kicked in, we all started to specialize because all of a sudden we were all part of one extended network. And specialization meant services and manufacturing jobs, and all of those were in town. So we started moving into the cities, and in cities, kids are no longer free labor, they're an expense. And you fast forward 70 years, and adults just had fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer of them. And after 70 years, the pyramid has shifted. At first, it was just you had fewer children and then fewer young adults, and it kind of became a chimney. And that gave us this absolutely magical growth structure, especially in the West, and especially in East Asia, from the 60s and the 70s up until almost now. Because you had a lot of people who were aged 20 to 65, but very few retirees and very few children. So all of the investment, all of the tax base, which was huge, could be spent on infrastructure and technology and education. And we got the fastest economic growth that we have ever seen as a species. And it moved around, but more or less lasted for 70 years. Well, you can only do that once. You can only urbanize once. And you can only benefit from that perfect demographic moment once. And what's happening now is there have been so few kids born for so long that most of the advanced economies, and this includes Germany and Italy and Japan and China, it's not that they've run out of kids or teenagers or 20-somethings or 30-somethings. They're now running out of 40-somethings and 50-somethings. And we have this massive inversion. It looks kind of like a top with the wide spot now approaching mass retirement. And what happens this decade is that wide spot moves past retirement. And we get to a situation where it's not where we have more retirees than children. We passed that a while ago. It's we have more retirees than we have children and young adults put together. And we have no idea what that will mean for our normal economic models of fascism and socialism and capitalism, because those are all based on growth, based on population. And that is now impossible for most of the largest economies of the world. In the case of the United States, it's a bit of an exception. We're still in that chimney stage, and our birth rate hasn't dropped enough to condemn us to that future. If we keep aging at the rate we're doing now, we won't be in a German-style situation until about 2070. Hopefully, that's a lot of time to figure out a new path, or at least, worst-case scenario, we get to see how the Germans and the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans and everyone else deals with this devolution. And hopefully we'll learn a few things about what to do or even just what not to do.
What happens, or what do you expect to happen when the largest cohort of retirees dies off, like I guess the baby boomers, when they age out of existence, what does that do to the economy?
You have to look, I mean, if that's a cultural question as much as anything. So you've got your American boomers and then your global boomers. They were formed at roughly the same time by roughly the same reason. The post-World War II euphoria when the GIs came home, they had a bunch of kids. Those are the boomers. And that happened even in the Soviet Union. the difference between the United States and most of the rest of the world is that our boomers had a lot of kids, and we know those as the millennials. And so we do have an echo boomer generation, and that's a big part of why our demographic decline has been so much slower. But that didn't happen almost anywhere else. So when the boomers die everywhere else, they've probably will have already absorbed all of the accrued capital from their lifetimes in pensions and healthcare, because they won't be paying taxes in the same volume anymore. And that'll bankrupt the states. And there's no longer a replacement generation down below to replenish the population. So you're looking at aging populations, denigrating populations, less investment capacity, because there's never the capital generation to exist in the first place now. In the United States, that's not necessarily true. I mean, I firmly believe that America's boomers aren't going to pass a lot of money on to their kids, because they're going to spend it on themselves. But we still have that younger generation coming up. The older boomers turn 45 years old this year. And that means in about 10 years, they're going to be entering their capital-rich stage of their life.
The older boomers...
I'm sorry. I said that wrong. The older millennials turn 45 this year. And as a rule, from age 55 to 65 is when you're the most capital-rich in your life. That's what everyone else in the world is losing. We just have a hiccup. As the boomers pass on, Gen X is small, but then the millennials will eventually catch up. So all, I'm using air quotes here, all we have to do in the United States to get back to a better capital generation moment is wait 12 years until the millennials will be doing it. But there aren't a lot of other countries in the world that will ever reach that point. France, New Zealand, Sweden, that's about it.
So what exactly are you picturing when you say something like Germany is going to deindustrialize and basically unravel or not exist as a state? I forget the language you use, but it was starkly dystopian. What are you actually picturing? What if we jumped in a time machine and went to the Germany of 2070, what are you expecting to see?
I wouldn't expect to see a Germany in 2070. I mean, that's part of the problem here. Everything that we're studying demographically, this has never happened before, never in human history. We've never seen this sort of decay, even in times of war and genocide, even in times of the Black Death. It's never happened this fast. It's never been this holistic. It's never happened everywhere. What I would anticipate is we're going to see a failure of the economic and the social models first. When you remove this mature worker generation from the equation as they age into mass retirement, these states go from the most capital flush they've ever been because of the boomers approaching retirement, not yet being there, to all of a sudden the boomers being a drag on state finances instead of their biggest source. And that generates, at best, a Greece-style financial collapse in most of the advanced world. In that sort of environment, assuming there's no security problem, you can look forward to, say, banana republic-style governing structures with devaluing currencies as they monetize to try to pay their bills. You get something that's significantly worse than Weimar-era Germany, if you were talking about the Germans specifically. But that also assumes there's not a security problem. And the Russians have made it very clear that there is a security problem as well. So you now have dwindling assets and a weaker state having to also possibly fight a war, if not indirectly, maybe even directly. So the stresses upon these governments and financial systems is going to be something we have not seen in the post-World War II environment, at the same time where state capacity to deal with the challenges will be the lowest that they have been in the post-World War II environment.
Well, so let's bring the current emergency of the war in Ukraine into the picture. What is happening there, on your view, and what is likely to happen, and what is Russia likely to do next? I hear you at some point, I think it was in your book, maybe it was in one of your videos, but you predicted that Russia has no intention to stop at Ukraine, and I think you even went so far as to say that you think they will eventually use nukes on NATO. I assume you meant tactical nukes in some...
No, strategic.
Okay, well, let's rip the lid off of that one.
Sure. Let's start with the world from Moscow's point of view. The Eurasian landmass is a big wide open with not a lot of great land. And the land that the Russians live in, the Russian wheat belt, is the least productive of the world's major agricultural zones in terms of output per acre. You get one crop of short season, low quality wheat, and that's it. And so the Russians have never been able to generate the capital that's necessary to fund a nationwide road network. So the only way they can move things in volume ever is by rail. And that's how they move everything. Mm. Now, the problem the Russians have is they don't have a very clear external borders. If you look at the lands where ethnic Russians live, even if you look at the modern incarnation of the Russian Federation, they've got about 5,000 miles of external border that don't have any natural barriers to prevent invasion. So the Russians have been invaded 50-odd times in their history, and it's always been a story of how far the invaders can get before, not the Russians defeat them, because the Russians can't move around, not even in their own territory. It's until the weather does it for them. General Winter has always been the strongest power in Russia. So if you're in Moscow, the only strategy that the czars and the communists and now the post-communist thugocracy that rules the country now, the only strategy that the Russians have ever found that allows them to defend themselves is to set up a preemptive system where they expand out of their semi-crappy land until they reach a series of geographic barriers that you just can't shove a panzer through. Things like the Carpathian Mountains, for example. And if you do that, you actually narrow the access points from 5,000 miles of Great Wide Open to only about 500 miles of funneled kill zones. And that requires conquering all or part of like 15 countries and a couple million square miles, of which includes all of Ukraine. But that is a defensive position that the Russian military actually can close. And that's what they achieved under the early Soviet period at the end of World War II. Of course, then the post-Soviet collapse, they lost almost all of the, not just the buffer territory, but their anchor points in those access points to the Eurasian central zones. So this war was always going to happen because it had to. The alternative is for Russia just to be completely unmoored in its own territories and fade away.
Except Ukraine, doesn't it seem quite unlikely that anyone is just itching to invade Russia?
Well, just because they're not doing it now doesn't mean that they won't do it in the future is the Russian position. And while I can't think of anyone, except for maybe the Chinese at the moment, that would think they have a vested interest in doing that, you can't make that bet for all times. And the demographic evolutions that have hit a lot of the rest of the world have not passed Russia's by. And so their ability to use military tactics to shape their neighborhood basically collapses this decade. And so if they were going to do it, they had to do it roughly now. And so this is the ninth post-Soviet war that the Russians have participated in, and all of them have been fought with an eye for the Russians reestablishing those forward positions and those access points. The problem for Ukraine is that Ukraine doesn't control those access points, but it's on the way to the two most important ones in Romania and Poland. So we know as much as we know of anything about Russian intentions is if they do succeed in Ukraine, they will then push for the next countries that actually occupy those gaps. And that's Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Moldova, Romania, and Poland. And five of the six of those are in NATO. So a clash with the Western powers was always where this eventually leads. And what has brought nukes into the equation has not been Russian aggression, but Russian weakness. Because we found out in the first couple of months of the war that the Russians don't know how to fight combined arms. In fact, they lost most of their military strategies and tactical capacity, not just from the Soviet period, but from the Tsarist period. Their army hasn't been functioning as an army. It's been functioning as a mob with weapons. And that means if they succeed in Ukraine and they end up in Poland and they come up face to face with the best military alliance in human history, the casualty ratios for the Russians will be obscene and they will be obliterated, but that will have not changed their military calculus for what they have to achieve. They have to get to the Vistula. They have to get to Warsaw. And so we will have a very, very short, very, very brutal negotiation that if it doesn't go very, very well and result in Washington and London and Berlin abandoning Poland and Estonia and Latvia and the rest, the nukes will fly because the Russians don't see they have another choice. Without success in these wars, the Russian population, the Russian government will probably cease to function as a nation state within 15 years. If they succeed, they buy themselves probably another half century. Their math is good on this. And so the decision was made very, very, very early in Berlin and in Stockholm and in London and Washington that anything that the Ukrainians can prove that they can operate and maintain, they can have. And the rest of it is details. Because if we can't keep this war bottled up in Ukraine, if it does come west, we start losing cities. And unfortunately, if the Ukrainians win, The only way that they can stop the Russians from trying again is to cross the border into Russia proper and take out a couple logistical hubs that unfortunately are also major cities, places like Belgorod and Rostov-on-Don. And that would probably prompt the Russians to use nukes in a defensive manner. So I know this sounds horrible, but a stalemate in Ukraine is probably the best case scenario for everyone except the Ukrainians.
Mm. So yeah, why is your expectation that of Russian use of nukes contingent upon them winning in Ukraine? Why wouldn't, if they're losing in Ukraine or even under a stalemate, why don't you think the use of nukes would be inevitable under those conditions? Isn't anything short of winning intolerable by your calculus?
Yeah, anything short of winning is absolutely intolerable. But if they're going to use nukes in Ukraine, that really doesn't help them very much.
No, but I mean, so the fact that we're supplying Ukraine, however indifferently mm-hmm. at this point, with weapons, as is our European allies that are closer to the theater of action. Why wouldn't the Russians use or threaten to use nukes on anyone supplying weapons to Ukraine at this point?
They did that in the first couple of months of the war, and two things happened. Number one, the Ukrainians proved that they could fight very well with very limited support from the West, at least temporarily. And so there was a while when they were thinking about nuking Warsaw specifically, because that's where most of the weapons were funneled through. But when more and more countries signed online and when more and more supply routes to the Ukrainians opened up, that lost a lot of its justification. And second, it was made very clear to Putin personally that we have real-time intelligence on his personal location at any given time. And so we made it very clear to him that if nukes were used on any NATO territory anywhere in the world, that the first nuke that would go back would be targeting him personally. And that focused a few minds in the Kremlin.
So why can't we maintain that deterrence?
That only works so long as we're locked up in Ukraine. If Ukraine falls, then it's a broader scale. And if Ukraine succeeds and all of a sudden the Russian border is the one that's under threat, then we're in a very different defensive strategic environment. So at the moment, keeping the nukes off the table means keeping the war within Ukraine's borders, more or less.
Well, it's still not clear to me why the stability of mutually assured destruction has fully eroded in your view. Why is Putin suicidal under certain of these scenarios? Because any significant use of nukes is obviously suicide from the Russian side, given our doctrine. I'm assuming we would hold to anything like our doctrine. If he nukes London and Berlin and New York, it's going to be game over in Russia. So I mean, how is that a plan?
The Russian demographic situation has decayed to such to the point that without a more secure outer perimeter, they probably will be gone as a functional country before 2040. When that is your understanding of your own country, the strictness of the systems of mutually assured destruction and a degree of trust, ironically, that we had during the Soviet period is gone. The Russians feel that if they can't pull this off all the way to the Danube, to the Vistula, that they're doomed anyway. And so if they need nukes to get something that conventionally they can't get, they are fully willing to do that. Now, I would guess that what would happen in this specific scenario, and everyone's scenarios here are a little loosey-goosey because this war has evolved in so many directions that nobody anticipated. So take this for what it is, just a guess. If Ukraine falls and the Russian military reaches the border with Poland and Romania and the Baltics, the Putin government would have a conference call with Germany or with Berlin and London and Stockholm and Washington. No, he probably wouldn't bring in Washington. And in Paris and say, hey, look, we've already programmed the nukes. They're going to launch tomorrow at noon unless you repudiate your alliance with those five states and immediately and publicly begin your withdrawal forces from all five of them. If you do that, we won't launch. And they'll try to break NATO one last time.
That's what
I would do if I was Putin.
And what do you think NATO should do under those conditions? I mean,
NATO does not want to have to make that decision. That's why we're backing Ukraine.
And on that front, do you think we should be backing Ukraine much more energetically than we are?
I think it's possible. There's two problems here, though. Number one, the baby bus that hit the rest of the world hit Ukraine actually harder than most. So they only have so many troops. And they now have had so many troops so engaged for so long, it's difficult for them to rustle up more troops to get trained on more advanced equipment. The next phase of training for the Ukrainians is going to be much more difficult than what's happened to this point, just because of the numbers. So it's not clear to me, and I know all of my friends in the military are stressing about this too, about what can be done to move things forward, even if the politics in the United States were perfect, of which they are not. The second problem is a little bit broader on the European front. You know, these Europeans spent 30 years preparing for a world where there would never be a war again. Mm. And after 2 years of giving the Ukrainians almost every weapon system they can think of, the cupboard's starting to get a little thin. So it's not clear to me what the next phase of the war is going to look like. Yes, the Russians have been exhausted. Yes, the Russians have lost all of their pre-war military, tanks, men, everything. But they have a Soviet stockpile to draw upon and another probably 6 million men in their 20s that they can draft.
Mm.
The West is going to have to figure out something else. Because even if the block on the aid in Congress goes away tomorrow, the Europeans are nearly spent. They've sent everything they can. And the United States is now starting to run out of the backlog of decommissioned military equipment that has been the bulk of our donations. About 80% by value, 70-80% by value of what we've sent is stuff that we don't use anymore. We have not really delved into our active equipment. And if we're going to continue support past this calendar year, we're either going to have to start making a lot of stuff that we haven't made in 30 years, or we're going to have to start training the Ukrainians on our top line equipment, which requires an order of magnitude more effort and supply and logistical tail. Whatever we go with requires a lot of military industrial expansion on the production side, and you don't do that overnight. So we're facing a number of crimp points in our support for Ukraine that is making this very uncomfortable.
But it also sounds like too much support would be a bad thing. It would tip us over into a nearer-term existential threat from the Russian point of view.
Absolutely a concern. I think that has become less of a concern over the last 16 months. The fact that the counteroffensives last year, from the Ukrainians did not amount to any significant breakthroughs, this is going to sound horrible, gives the United States a little bit of confidence that that scenario, the Russians fighting a nuclear war defensively, is a little further off. Mm. There's nothing about this that is pretty for anyone.
All right, so how much land do you have in New Zealand, and what are your favorite MRE brands?
I actually have a New Zealand degree, and my job is portable, so I can qualify for citizenship in a day if I decide mm-hmm. that I want to. And Peak Refuel is my go-to. Thank God for the preppers. They put a lot of money into that freeze-dried stuff. It actually tastes pretty good now.
Mm. Okay, China. What's happening over there? And why shouldn't we all be investing in the Chinese stock market at this point?
Well, you know, you do with your money what you want to. Let's see. When we spoke last, it was about 8 months ago. Does that sound right?
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Okay. So at that point, it was literally a week before the new demographic data came out. And so at the time that you and I were speaking with Ian Bremmer, China was already the fastest aging society in the world and had the third or fourth fastest aging workforce ever recorded of any time. And they were on path to seeing their workforce cease to exist as a functional unit within a decade. Less than a week later, the data was updated, and they were then reporting that their number of fresh births year on year had dropped by more as a percentage of their population than what had happened to the Jews of Europe during the Holocaust since 2017, which, you know, there's no historical analog for that at all. And in the last month, they've updated the data again to indicate that they may have still overcounted the number of births that they've had in the last 5 years, because the number of kids that are enrolling in kindergarten is sharply lower than what they were expecting just 12 months ago. So we are seeing a country that is not in demographic decay, but is in the advanced stages of irreversible demographic collapse. And they are now literally running out of people in their late 40s already. And this is not even the worst case scenario. What's his name? Yu Fuxuan, I believe. I'm probably mispronounced that. Apologies. But he's a Chinese demographer who thinks that the overcount in the Chinese population is probably about 250 million people.
Hmm.
We are looking at nothing short of a civilizational collapse over the course of the next 15 years.
And so,
I would not invest in the stock market.
And how would you expect them to behave in the meanwhile? You know, the CCP on down.
Yeah, if I was going to use air quotes and, you know, a normal country, there might be any number of policy prescriptions that you could try to at least buy some more time or deflect this a little bit. But Chairman Xi has so inoculated the system. He's purged so thoroughly that there's no one left. Decision-making capacity within the government has almost fallen to zero. He's established himself as the sole decision maker, but he's also penalized the transfer of information. So the bureaucracy has responded to this by not even collecting data anymore, much less transmitting it. And so we're seeing policy collapses across the length and the breadth of the entire system that is really confusing the business community because they're not used to seeing this. At the same time, that you get a crackdown in the business community for being the only part of the system where there's, you know, some thought and planning going on. This is not the recipe for something that's going to last a decade. The Chinese are almost itching, it seems, to find their way to state failure as quickly as possible. I don't mean that they're doing that on purpose, but I mean they're sabotaging their own government in honor of the cult of personality.
It seems that much of the foreign policy establishment has not gotten this particular memo, and I still hear China routinely described as the other superpower, the emerging one, and the question is whether we're going to fall into some Thucydides trap with them.
Sure.
Graham Allison wrote a book by that title.
Now, in defense of Graham, real quick, he did point out that only happens half the time. Thucydides trap is not something that happens every time there's a transfer of power or a rise of a new power. It happens about half the time. In addition, yep, the Chinese rise was largely because of the American-led globalized order. And they are actually more dependent upon that now than they were before. So if there were a war, the Chinese would not just lose it. They would lose it so thoroughly, they would have a deindustrialization collapse complete with a famine in a very short period of time.
So what are you expecting with them to do with respect to Taiwan?
That's an open question. If the Russians succeed with what they want to do in Ukraine and Poland and Romania and the rest, they actually do buy themselves a lot of time. They get in a much better strategic position, and they will probably persist till the very end of this century. I think that's a realistic possibility.
How do they buy themselves time demographically? I mean, don't they suffer the same demographic collapse or by absorbing those countries?
The demographic situation is still problematic. Don't mean to suggest it's going to get better. But by being able to plug their military access points, they can focus most of the manpower that they have remaining on maintaining civil control. And if there's one thing the Russians know how to do, it's how to put down a protest. If they don't have to worry about the exterior power, they can worry about the interior elements. And they are, unfortunately, quite good at that. China doesn't have something like that. There's no place that China can go. There's no land they can occupy. There's no resource that they can secure that heads off their problems. They are the world's largest importer of almost every raw commodity, foods included. They import 80% of the stuff they need to grow their own food, and they're the world's largest food importer. They need a globalized system, healthy, vibrant, functional, and made safe by someone else. If they launch a war, they lose access to all of that overnight. So a war, even in Taiwan, that conquers the entire place without a shot, conquers Tokyo without a shot, Manila, Jakarta, all of it, take the entire first island chain, everyone just accedes, it's still not enough. They need full access to the entire globe for both consumption and production. And that's not going to be in the cards ever. So if
you're betting on famine in China.
You mean if I'm betting on famine again in China?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have a very different picture of America's future, although I'm not sure how sanguine it is, given the fact that we may be experiencing a nuclear winter, which will not observe any political borders.
That would suck.
Yeah. Just how rosy is your picture of life in America, given what you've said about the prospects of failing to avoid a nuclear war, which is really more or less everyone's assumption about the future?
Fair enough. Well, China, I think, is going to ultimately descend into a disintegration where it falls apart in its own juices. I think the challenge of the China disintegration is going to be largely one of replacing the industrial plant that's necessary somewhere else in the world, in North America, before we lose all the Chinese stuff. And that's a bit of a race. And I'm actually been fairly optimistic at how fast the American business community has moved. In the last 5 years, we've seen industrial construction spending more than quadruple in the United States. And in the electronics space, it's increased by a factor of 10. Now, we need more. We need more. But that's a good start. The Russian situation, assuming for the moment that we can help the Ukrainians engineer the death of the Russian military on the plains of eastern and southern Ukraine, then that problem becomes one of a second Russian disintegration. And I don't mean to suggest there won't be a lot to manage there, but that will probably, fingers crossed, keep the Russian disintegration wrapped up within the borders of today's Russian Federation as non-Russian ethnic groups rise up, as they have in the past, and attempt to control their own destinies. And the groups to follow most closely are the Tatars and the Bashkirs, who are Turkic descendant groups, kind of like the Chechens, but much more sophisticated, much more technologically commanding, and sitting on the most important infrastructure within the Russian Federation. They control the cluster of pipes and power lines and roads and rail that connect all of Siberia to European Russia. And if the Russians lose that, that takes most of the oil patrimony overnight. And I think that's the most likely outcome over the course of the next 20 years, assuming the Russians don't proceed past Ukraine. That's ultimately a part of the long-term problem that the Russians have identified as justifying the war in the first place, so they can focus on keeping those peoples down. It's not a stupid plan. It's simply a dangerous one.
Given that that's what success looks like, the disintegration of Russia without starting a nuclear war with the West, the first thing I think about under those conditions is that now, you know, Russia becomes an even scarier, you know, by a factor of 1,000 version of North Korea. And with lots of loose nukes to worry about, that's what avoids a nuclear war on your account. What, if anything, can anyone do about that? I mean, the prospect of loose nukes under a complete disintegration of Russia is pretty terrifying.
Well, let me point out two things. Number one, we've been here already. This basically happened in the 1990s. You had de facto independence movements in a number of the Russian republics, including in Tatarstan. And we almost got to this point. Second, the loose nukes question, unfortunately, is a series of unknowns stacked on top of a series of even more unknowns. But consider the state of the Russian military the first month of the war and how badly it did and how badly the equipment performed, even if it was in the hands of supposedly soldiers who knew what they were doing. We have no idea what the status of the Russian nuclear arsenal is. We do know that everything that the defense minister has touched has suffered. Shoigu has easily stolen 1/3 of the defense budget in Russia personally, and probably another 1/3 by his cronies. That includes the nuclear arsenal. It's entirely possible, and I think this is the Biden administration's nightmare scenario here, that the Putin government hits the red button and nothing happens. What do you do when someone attempts to nuke you and fails? Because you know they're going to like rip apart the panel and try to hit that big red button again. What's your plan for that? But what that suggests to me is every day that passes where a nuke doesn't fly is a day where those weapons degrade a little bit more. And I'm not suggesting that we're not setting ourselves up for the next major security crisis. That's absolutely in the cards here. But spinning down an old nuke in order to re-up its punch requires facilities that exist in very few parts of the world, in really just 7 countries. So if you were to give a random dude an old nuke, it's not like he can blow up a city, probably. And I realize it's a probably on a maybe. But it's not something I spend too much time being overly stressed about, because at the moment, the strategic nukes are in the silos and controlled by a major power. And they are far more dangerous there today than they would be 15 years from now in some random dude's hands.
Okay, so back to the happy talk about America. Why is life so good in America when everything unravels everywhere else?
Okay, in a post-China, post-Germany environment, we're looking at a massive amount of industrial plant on the tune of probably $40 to $50 trillion that needs to be relocated somewhere else. Now, doing that in an environment of the retiring boomers and capital constraints is a massively inflationary operation that will also generate the fastest economic growth in the countries that are able to participate in it. So I would anticipate over the course of the next several years, let's call it a decade at tops, that we're going to roughly double the size of the industrial plant in North America, leveraging American capital and labor with Mexican consumption and labor, and with the Canadians coming in to help wherever they can. That is an amazing growth story. It's a stressful one. It will push everything we have to the limit. But, you know, the fastest growth in history, that's nothing to sniff at. That, in my mind, is a great story. It's against a backdrop of a lot of global crap, but it gets us to a place where our supply chains are largely immune to international shocks. That's a plus.
What about the problem of U.S. debt going forward?
Okay, I'm a fiscal conservative, so I really don't like talking about this issue. But it's really hard for me, when I look at it geopolitically, to get too concerned. And that doesn't mean that I think that Biden or Trump or Obama or W had the capacity of crafting a meaningful economic policy. I think they all failed. But a few things to look at. First of all, let's talk about outer reaches. How far can we go before it's a problem? Japan's national debt, if you include pension arrears today, is over 500% of GDP, so four times ours. And they're still there, and they are not the global currency. So even in the worst case scenario, we can quadruple our debt from our current levels, and it might be make for some uncomfortable thinking in a number of ways, but it wouldn't destroy the country. Second, we get a lot free. As long as we maintain our long-term growth pattern, which for the last 50 years has been about 3% a year, that means the first $800, $850 billion of debt is kind of free because it doesn't expand the debt load as a percentage of the economy. That's a lot of wiggle room. And in a number of years of the last 20, our deficit expansion has been below that level. Third, there is no hint of any challenge to the US dollar as the global currency. And as long as that is the case, anything that we do that is debt-driven actually hurts most of the rest of the world more than everybody else, and actually reduces the cost of the US dollar versus other currencies. And considering most of the other currencies are facing long-term degradation from demographic reasons, having a little degradation of our own actually makes us a little bit more competitive. Not my preferred way of getting there, but you know, you take your good news where you can these days. The Europeans confiscated the insured bank deposits of the depositors during their financial crisis. And so everyone who could get out of the euro did. It's just a regional currency now. It's sufficient for that purpose, but it's never going to be a global competitor. The Brits removed them from the equation with Brexit, especially since they haven't figured out what's next. The Japanese tried to go global in the 80s and it blew up in their face and they will never try that again. The Chinese yuan is not convertible and people forget that the money supply in China is over double what it is here, despite the fact that they're not a currency of trade and they're not a currency that stores value. They've done everything to their money supply that all the gold hawks say that the Fed is doing, and they've been doing it harder and longer. So there's no competition there. And my personal favorite is BRICS, because in the opening statements in Johannesburg last year, the Chinese, Indians, and South Africans, all in their opening statements, said they had no interest in a BRICS currency at all, and they wanted just the dollar system to continue, and would people please stop asking them about it? But that doesn't match with the discussion in financial circles in the United States. So that was very underreported.
I just want to take a moment to entertain a counterfactual here.
Sure.
See, you've got you know, fairly explicit and hair-raising, in many cases, predictions. What would have to happen for them not to be true? I mean, let's just take two points here. You take the bearishness on Europe or on China versus the bullishness on America. Let's just say that the opposite is the case. You know, Europe thrives, China thrives, and America stagnates. What is the scenario that could make such a thing happen, which is to say falsify those two core predictions of yours?
I would say there's two moving parts, which are difficult to predict, that in theory could deflect my forecast significantly. The number one is the countries who have agency. In a world where trade works, you have to have a semi-militarized system to ensure that civilian traffic on the seas can go wherever it wants to, whenever it wants to. And if the United States decides to use its agency to protect this system, regardless of what it thinks about getting in return, then the United States can inject life into this system to a degree. We can't do it on a global basis. We no longer have the naval forces for that. But we could choose to stabilize one or two regions. And we would have to choose. Is it going to be Western Europe? Is it going to be East Asia? Is it going to be South Asia? Is it going to be the Middle East? We're going to have to pick. And based on who we choose, that will deflect the future for that region. And that in turn may have second order effects that benefit some other regions. So, you know, watch the Americans. If we decide not to go as populist and nationalist as we seem to be on both sides of the aisle, that matters a great deal. And then the second is, if you change the rules of the game on me, if you change the technologies in play, I fully reserve the right to change my mind. So, for example, right now the green transition can't happen. The materials that we need to do it don't exist. We have never doubled the output of any raw material that was already in use in a decade period ever in human history. And within the next 10 years, we need 3 times as much copper and 10 times as much nickel and 18 times as much graphite and on and on and on. It's 20 different materials that we need to more than double in 10 years. It can't happen. It won't happen unless the technology changes. If we figure out an inexpensive room temperature superconductor and a better battery chemistry tomorrow, well, then I have to do a lot of reevaluating. And if you change the map of energy so it's not dependent upon freedom of the seas, it's something easy to do, well, that changes a lot of the geopolitics that drive this world and changes a lot of the restrictions that I think right now are going to be crippling otherwise.
But it doesn't change any of the demography.
It doesn't change the demography. For demography, we would need a different sort of technological advance. I mean, I say this little tongue-in-cheek, but only a little. We need Star Wars-style cloning where you can grow a full adult in 3 years and they have a full skill set. Just skip over the child's part. Because if we double the birth rate in most countries right now, you don't get your 25-year-olds who are skilled labor for 25 years. That's not soon enough. We'll be well past the collapse by then. So you have to shorten the time frame. So whether it's robotics and artificial intelligence being a new race or mass cloning, those are the only ways that I can see to get around the demographic problem. And clearly, we're light years away from those potential, air quote, solutions.
All right. So take me to the chaos at the southern border of the U.S. and
you're just asking all the fun questions.
Yeah, yeah. The norms we should strive to adhere to around immigration. I mean, what is the sane immigration policy that we should want or should want to want? And what are the prospects of actually containing, actually having a defensible southern border or, you know, and northern border for that matter, wherein we actually know who's coming into the country and we can let in who we actually want in?
Yeah, the trick is to have an immigration system that incentivizes cooperation with authorities as opposed to penalizes it. So under the Trump administration, we basically blocked all routes to legal migration, leaving only illegal migration as an option to get in. And that overwhelmed the system and made it impossible to cope with the influx. And before you condemn Trump for that, keep in mind that the Biden administration has not changed a damn thing in that regard. Illegal migration remains basically blocked completely. What we need is a root and branch overhaul of the immigration system as a whole, which we have not done since the late 1980s. So there's a lot of things that would need to change. If you're looking for the policy that we've adopted in the last century that I thought was most promising, you have to go back to, among all presidents, the Carter administration. A couple of major hurricanes hit Central America, and these people's homes, livelihoods, and sources of food disappeared overnight. And so they started walking north. And there was no way to get them to stay because there was nothing for them to stay for. So what Carter did is he dispatched the Department of Immigration down to Central America and issued 3-year work permits to everyone who wanted one. And as long as for those 3 years you paid your taxes and kept your nose clean and kept out of trouble, at the end of 3 years, you could either get a ticket home courtesy of the U.S. government, you could apply for a 1-year extension and there was a fee, or you could start the possibility of achieving citizenship. And it worked beautifully. And so, of course, we've never done it since. In terms of getting a different policy right now, I think that's impossible. We're going through a political transition right now where both the Republicans and the Democrats are redefining what they are. And the faction that is most in play right now doesn't know which side it's going to fall on is organized labor. And the issue that they are most opposed to is immigration reform or migration at all. So no one in the Republican or Democratic Party wants to even talk about a meaningful reform of the system until such time as they know which side organized labor is going to fall on. And I doubt we're going to get that this year or even next year. We'll get it this decade, and I hope kind of forward positioned in the decade from this point, but I don't think it's in the immediate future and certainly not before the federal elections. In the meantime—
How much immigration would we actually want given our demographic trends?
Well, that absolutely needs to be part of the conversation, but historically speaking, we've taken about 1.5 to 2 million people a year every year. And that is something that from a cultural point of view, we have shown ourselves perfectly capable of absorbing. What's going to be different in the future versus the past, though, is that the makeup of that population is going to evolve quite a bit. Because of NAFTA, because of Mexico's late coming into the industrialized family of nations, it has been industrializing and urbanizing since 1990 on a pace that's much more rapid than what happened in Europe, say, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that means that the birth rate in Mexico has plummeted. And it's gotten to the point that starting about 15 years ago, net migration from Mexico to the United States went flat. So for the better part of 50 years, the immigration story was a Mexico story. In the last 15 years, it's changed from a Mexico story to a Central American story. But there was also a free trade agreement with the Central Americans that it was implemented in the early 2000s called CAFTA, which means that the birth rate in Central America has also been plummeting. So by the end of this decade, the Central Americans will follow the Mexicans' footpath and not have enough young people to send north. So if we don't get meaningful immigration reform, the next phase of our immigration inflows is, well, we already know what it looks like because it started, but it's going to become much more intense. It's not going to be our southern neighbors walking north. It's going to be people in distress or people who are fleeing from all over the world, just entering through the southern border because it's more porous. We haven't yet begun to process what that means for us culturally because the Hispanic influx, the Mexican influx, has changed America, but it's changed in a way and at a speed and with a single point of input that I think we've all been able to manage more or less. And I think one of the great things that Donald Trump did do was convince most of the people in his political camp that the Mexicans are part of the family now. That was significant. I did not see that coming. But what happens when it's Indians and Chinese and Rwandans and Angolans? Because that's the direction we're moving. It's a much more complicated picture culturally, politically, from a law enforcement point of view. It's not an issue of just sending people back across the border if you decide you want to close it because they're not from there. And again, we need to have that conversation before we get to that point.
Do you, you think it's actually practically impossible to have a border that is impervious to illegal immigration?
Oh, it absolutely is. One of the things we discovered under the Trump administration is if you try to build a wall, the first thing you have to do is build construction roads across the Chihuahuan and Sonoran deserts to reach the border. And what you have done by building those roads is obviate half of the greatest natural barrier in the continent, an unpatrolled, an unpatrolled border is much more secure at keeping out illegal migrants than one that is fortified. Because to fortify it, you have to build the infrastructure that allows the people to cross. Mm. It's a little ass backwards, but it holds. Donald Trump will go down in his history as the most pro-illegal migrant president we've ever had.
And that will be not be among his chief flaws, as it turns out. Speaking of—
That feels like a trap. I'm going to go with a no comment on that one.
Well, I'm going to drag you into the morass with me. Because the next question is about the 2024 presidential election.
Okay.
What do you, I think I saw a video of you more or less predicting that Trump can't possibly win given the nature of the map electorally. And this is at odds with literally everything that's being said in the news. Why don't you think Trump can win?
Okay. So there's two big reasons that have basically condemned Trump to lead the Republicans into what is going to be the second or third greatest electoral defeat in American history. The first one has to do with the nature of the Republican alliance. The reason the Republicans have historically done well at the ballot box, especially in presidential campaigns, is their coalition doesn't fight. So you've got your social conservatives who don't care about military policy. You've got your military voters who don't care about fiscal policy. You have your fiscal policy voters who don't care about national defense and on and on and on. You've got a relatively tight coalition with only a few factions. No one gets pissed off when another faction gets their way, and everyone shows up to vote. It's reliable. Maybe small, but it's reliable. The Democrats are kind of a mess. You've got your coastal elites, you have your organized labor, and you've got your various minorities, and they fight all the time about everything. They have different opinions on what civil rights even means. I mean, you talk to gays and blacks, you get different answers. You want to talk industrial policy, you talk to greens and unions, you get different answers. So it's hard for them to win at the federal level because anyone who tries to run on the issues and in energizing one faction, they piss off another one and not everyone shows up to vote. Okay. What has happened under Trump is he started that Democratic style internecine warfare on the Republican side. And so we're not going to get everyone to show up in the first place. So just on the merits, Republicans will defeat Trump just by not showing up. Second problem, independents. People have forgotten what went down in the midterms. We've only had two examples before last year, year before last, I guess now, in American history, where the party that was not in control of the presidency did so badly in the midterm. And that's because Donald Trump spent 2 years telling the world that the general elections in the United States doesn't matter. It should all be decided at the primary level where he dominates. Well, for an independent voter, the general election is the only place that you matter. And so the general response was hold my beer. And they voted massively against any candidate that Donald Trump personally endorsed. For the Republicans to win in a typical year, they not only need to hold their coalition together, but because it's a smaller coalition, they need to get at least a majority, preferably two-thirds, of independent voters. They can't do that anymore. Not only is their own coalition breaking, but independents are strongly voting against anything that touches Trump. And a 2-to-1 swing against them, like what we saw in the midterms, is a far more likely outcome for 2024 than anything else. That tells me, just looking at the numbers, that Trump is probably going to carry 10 or 12 states, none of them big, none of them including Florida or Texas, and it's just a question of how long the coattails are from those decisions. I have no idea about the coattails. Americans are very finicky on that.
Why wouldn't the current political polling be tracking this? I mean, if you're polling likely voters, and presumably independents are also included in those polls, so is it just that you're assuming that the people who imagine that they're likely voters aren't in fact likely voters?
Well, we have a data problem and a definition problem. The data problem is that true independent voters don't do polls, and certainly not a year out. Second, there's a definition problem. You've got roughly, let's call it 25 to 30% of the population that's hard Democrat and hard Republican. They're not going to be swayed. You've got another 15 to 20% that says they're on each side, that says they're independents, but really they vote for the Republicans or the Democrats over 90% of the time. So they're not really independents. The 10% in the middle, those are the ones that matter. Those are the ones who decide elections and they never answer polls.
You mean they just, these are the kind of people who just hang up when the pollster calls?
Yeah, exactly. And they don't even start thinking about politics in a meaningful way, oftentimes until they're driving to the voting booth.
All right. Well, this is one of your predictions, which has the merit of being confirmable very or disconfirmable.
Easy to vote up or vote no very, very soon. Yes.
7.5 months, we will know, or thereabouts.
Now, this all, of course, assumes that Biden doesn't die and Trump's not in jail, which are, of course, non-zero risks.
Right. What would you expect to happen if Biden died or was otherwise unfit or less fit than he is?
If Biden dies after the Democratic convention, then it's Kamala Harris. Hmm. And in a Harris versus Trump fight, I think Trump would probably prevail. If Trump goes to prison before the Republican convention, then the Republicans have an opportunity to pick someone else, anyone else. And any other Republican would probably wipe the floor with Joe Biden.
Hmm.
So timing of the conviction and timing of the death would really matter. And if we're going to talk about Joe Biden dying, we have to talk about Donald Trump dying because, you know, they're only we're born like an hour and a half apart.
What was it, 4 years apart?
Yeah, if Trump were to become our next president, he would be the oldest president ever to take office, just like Joe Biden would be.
Right. All right. Well, so given this litany of fairly grim prognostications, what is your level of I mean, you don't strike me as a gloomy guy. You don't strike me as a lunatic prepper who's spending all your time hedging your bet against the future. What is it like to be you, given that these are the kinds of thoughts you spend a lot of your time, you know, all of your professional time thinking?
I actually feel pretty good. The globalized period was a period in history. It was never going to last forever. And now we're in an interregnum between this and whatever comes next. And whatever comes next is going to involve the United States in a very good position. So we're going through the changes right now, and that's awkward, and that's painful, and that's part of our political process too. But we've gotten through it before. As to the American political phases, I think, unfortunately, that we're going to go into a much more isolationist retrenchment position, regardless of what happens with our presidential politics. Mm-hmm. I think that is a fairly strong belief on both the left and the right now. And even if there was another popular option right now, I don't think we'd be able to really discuss it until the Democrats and the Republicans reform as whatever they're going to be next. And But I have confidence there that we'll get there, because this is not the first time that our political system is broken down and reformed. It is the sixth. It's just that—
Why do you say unfortunately, given that—
Well, I would like for us to go back to 1992 and have that conversation about the sort of world we want to see. Mm. I would love to have that conversation, open, honest, direct, and forward-looking. But that's not going to happen.
Aren't you saying, I mean, isn't the picture grim enough demographically that it's not a burden that the U.S. can truly lift? I mean, that whatever contribution we make to the global welfare on your account is going to be, on some level, at our own disadvantage?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, part of what makes me sad is that this political transition is happening at a time where American decisions are going to shape the human condition for the remainder of the century, and we're incapable of having a conversation about what those decisions should be. Mm-hmm. So at the point where, and this is more or less the story of the last 30 years, going through this transition in the post-Cold War environment, this had been the time for leadership, and we haven't had any. And this is kind of the last chance to tilt the world in whatever direction we think would be better. And we're not going to have it this year or next year. I mean, hopefully we'll finish our own internal transition before the next presidential election. But by that point, there's really not a lot that could be done for the Chinas and the Italys and the Germanys and the Koreas of the world.
Well, Peter, it's always interesting. Thank you for the time you've taken here. And I'm looking forward to seeing how the conversation with you evolves, because you've put a lot of markers on the calendar, and I will definitely ping you about the near-term one with the election, because it'll be
that's fair.
That's the only prediction of yours I like at this point, apart from American prosperity. So,
if you look at how our industrial plant has been expanding in the last 36 months, it's a really good story. We just need more.
Nice. Well, onward. Thanks again, Peter.
My pleasure.